for your consideration. This Thursday movie night on Arena, Creepy Norwegian Kids, a universe-hopping laundromat owner and a tender biopic of a much-loved poet and anti-war campaigner. Brace yourself for this film title. Everything Everywhere All at Once, a mind-bending sci-fi movie from The Daniels and starring the always interesting Michelle Yeoh in what some are describing as the role of her career. Yes, this is the woman who starred in Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and didn't do too badly in that, did she? We spoke earlier this week to Eskil Vught about his psychological horror film, The Innocents, which depicts the challenging behaviour of a group of supernaturally gifted children in a Norwegian apartment block. And in Benediction, cinema legend Terence Davies brings us a biopic of the revered war poet Siegfried Sassoon, played at different stages of life by Jack Loudon and later by Peter Capaldi. Joining me this evening, Angela Flannery and John Maguire. And let's start with Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is in cinemas nationwide. Even the title, John, is audacious, one could say.
It's even more expansive and ambitious than the all-encompassing title suggests, Sean. This is the brain-scrambling, dimension-hopping, kung-fu, sci-fi, comedy, Everything Everywhere All at Once, written and directed by Daniel Scheinert and Daniel Kwan, who called themselves Daniels, who previously gave us Daniel Radcliffe as a farting corpse being used as a jet ski in Swiss Army Man. They directed one of the greatest music videos of all time for Little John's Turn Down for What. These guys have a very distinctive and unique style. And they write their originators, they write their own stories, they make their own props. They even appear in the movie, they appeared in the music videos. They do it all. And right. there is that handmade, loving aesthetic all the way through this film.
All right. When I saw sci-fi, kung fu, comedy, I thought, all of that in one go. But that's only scraping the surface, I think, Angela. Given that there is so much happening and so much going on at high speed, I think, for the most part, is there a problem following this, or do you just need to leave that at the door?
Well, I won't lie, Sean, I couldn't follow it. You know, I sat in the cinema and I just thought, what's going on here? I hadn't a clue what was happening. So, you know, in that situation, you're better off just sitting back and enjoying the ride, you know, which I did. It's just too much hard work to try and figure out which multiverse or which plane you're in or what the hell is going on, because there are, you know, as you say, it's kung fu, it's family drama, it's black comedy, it's all of this stuff. And when you sit back and let it just wash over you, oh my God, it's such a riot. It is so much fun. And Michelle Yeoh is just extraordinary. It is the performance of her career. I mean, she does so much in this. You know, she's got great comedic timing. Like, we know she does her own stunts. You know, she wasn't a martial arts expert. She was a dancer who, you know, convincingly was able to do all these martial arts from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon onwards. But she is just, you know, she does all of that, you know. And I'm not going to be ageist about it, but this is a woman approaching 60 and she's still able to do that and do her stunts, do the comedy. But also there's a very sweet kind of family drama in this as well, and there's serious parts in it, and she can act as well. So I mean, who else can do that? She's extraordinary.
No, not too many, it has to be admitted. But I suppose, John, to give the listeners some kind of hook into where Michelle Yeoh was playing this character Evelyn Wang. Now, she's in trouble with the tax man, the tax person. Of course,
her
it is.
Her marriage is falling apart.
Her
laundrette is going to the wall.
Her daughter is coming out as lesbian, and she's not at all happy about that.
Yeah.
But the multiverse aspect of this is kind of the escape clause. Can you explain it in easy terms?
Unlike Angela, I had no problem following this. And I think Daniel's doing an amazing job of putting you exactly where you're supposed to be.
You're a multiverse type of guy, are you?
Well, yeah, I could flick through the different parallel dimensions, Sean, no problem. And I could keep up with this. But to distill it as closely as we can, she meets this dashing alternate incarnation of Waymond, who's her husband in our reality. He's played by Short Round himself.
And he's rather dull in our reality.
Kwan. Exactly. And he's trying to divorce her, and he's trying to pluck up the courage to divorce her. So she meets this version of him that's quite this dashing hero, and he informs her that she is actually able to commune with the infinite realities in the multiverse, a popular place in the current cinema, but one the Daniels have designed with all the number-crunching digital effects of the Marvel iteration. So she's got two little Bluetooth headphones that she sticks in either ear, and that allows her to flick through
parallel worlds from one universe to the other.
Why would she need to do that? Because their daughter, Joy, who's played by Stephanie Hugh, She's this eye-rolling young woman who's exasperated with her mother's failure to come to terms with her being a lesbian, is in fact, in the multiverse, this omnipotent god, and not a benign or kindly god. She's out for vengeance. Right. And okay. Her target is Michelle Yeoh's character, Evelyn.
All right, so I think I kind of have a bit of a hang on it there. However, I don't know if this clip is going to help in any way. Precious little, by the way, of dialogue available from Everything Everywhere. But if you ever wondered what Kung Fu sounds like using a fanny pack or a bum bag, you might call it, I suppose, this is what that all sounds like.
Okay, sir, that's enough.
John McGuire's having a great laugh to that. Angela, did that bring back a smile to your face? Clearly, I presume it's Michelle Yeoh doing a lot of that fighting in the midst of all of that action that we heard.
Yeah, it did. It's a very, very funny film. You know, I mean, it's surreal, it's psychedelic, and there's really all sorts of surreal features around googly eyes and sausage fingers and sex toys. I mean, it's that strange, and there's a very disorientating kind of montage sequence that's pure psychedelia in the middle of it that had my head spinning around 360, you know, but also laugh out loud moments of comedy. And it's one of the most unusual things I've ever seen. And I would have thought, God, I don't think I could enjoy this, but I had a riot. I was in great form coming out of it because it was just so much fun.
Yeah, and we should explain the tax person in the midst of all of this is Jamie Lee Curtis' character, John.
Yeah. She's superb. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is a great actress, and she turns up dressed like, well, it's actually going to be impossible to describe how she's dressed. And she plays this very officious tax inspector who's trying to put the squeeze on Michelle Yeoh's character, Evelyn. And then she turns into a kind of a kung fu kicking, high kicking monster who comes after them with this extraordinary vengeance.
Why did I ask?
Yeah. But Angela's quite right. This is a sensory experience. You're not supposed to pick holes in it. You're just supposed to sit back and let it wash over you. But more than that, what the Daniels have done is this extraordinary homage to the long history of Asian cinema, from the Hong Kong cinema of the 70s and 80s that Michelle Yeoh came out of, to Wong Kar-wai's elegant romances, anime, John Woo, Kurosawa. There's bits of Kubrick, there's bits of The Matrix. It's all in there. It is literally everything all at once. And it's destined to be a cult film, Sean.
All right. How many stars is it getting?
4 for me. I had a great time.
4. And what about you, Angela?
Well, John left out Ratatouille, which is really important.
Ratatouille is central to it, absolutely. Yeah.
There's a reference to Ratatouille, as well.
Yeah, and you know, you will kind of, I definitely sat there when Jamie Lee Curtis appears. I was like, that can't be her. It is her as Deirdre Bo Beardra, you know, who's taking on, really taking issue with this sort of shoebox accountancy that's going on in the laundromat. She's just a revelation. It's really, really good. I'm edging towards the 5 stars because behind it all is a really sweet and kind of, you know, this middle-aged woman in a family drama, and the world she has to save is her own world. And that just, it's very touching in the end, despite all the insanity. All right. But yeah, I'd go for the 5.
Oh, you've gone to the 5. And I suppose, Jamie Lee Curtis, do you want to play a character called Deirdre Bo Beardra? The answer is yes. I don't need to see any more. Let's move on then to film number 2, The Innocents. A story of creepy kids with psychic powers, perhaps without a moral compass, in a Norwegian housing complex, where else but on the edge of a forest. It's written and directed by Eskil Fucht, who was Oscar nominated this year for his scriptwriting work along with Joachim Trier on the indie hit The Worst Person in the World. John, we spoke with Eskil Fucht on Monday night. This is a real departure, it has to be said, from The Worst Person in the World.
This is not the kind of film that him or Joachim Trier generally make. Vogt has had made one previous feature, Blind. which was a drama, straight drama, really.
Yeah.
This, if the title of The Innocents evokes Jack Clayton's 1961 adaptation of The Turn of the Screw, the Henry James short story, that's no accident. Both stories are about seemingly innocent youngsters who can access these uncanny powers at a kind of an atavistic level, and they keep their abilities secret from the world of adults. That's crucial to it. What Vokes has done here is he's taken the ordinary everyday, he's introduced an element of magic, and he lets what play out, this extraordinary psychological drama set at eye level, you know, pint size protagonists. It's really set
it's
at
the
child's
point
eye
of
level
view all the time,
all the way through it, and it's really quite exceptional. But there's something we can't even hint at. There's a something right at the centre of the story that sent a shiver down my spine. That is just so creepy when the true implications of what's going on here sink in as you're watching, and it really sent a shiver down my
spine.
Well,
let's have just give us a sense of the four children at the very centre of the story, Angela, because it's their story essentially.
It is, yeah. I mean, you know, there's four unknown child actors who the adult actors in this are furniture, essentially, except perhaps one of the mothers. But a family move into this flat complex on the edge of a forest in an unnamed Norwegian town, and with their two daughters, Ida, who's about 9 years old, and her older sister, who's about 11, Anna, and Anna is autistic and nonverbal. It's summertime, so the complex is more or less abandoned, but there are two other children there. There's Ben and Aisha, both of whom are the only children of single mothers who are left in the complex. And so Ida and Anna befriend Ben and Aisha. And that's it kind of takes off from there, you know.
Ben,
it's Ida's... Sorry?
Yeah, Ben has these psychic powers. He's telekinetic, is that the right
term? Telekinesis, yeah. He can move things with his mind.
He can make things move. Yeah. While Aisha then has a telepathic quality, which means she can kind of think things and then another character can speak them. It kind of is the sisters being and how they're affected by this particular... these particular psychic powers, John.
Yeah.
But there is a family story being told in terms of Anna, the older sister's autism, and the younger sister. How is that handled?
Well, essentially, the younger sister, Ida, who's played by the newcomer Rekkel Flotum, she is jealous, essentially, of the amount of attention that her older nonverbal autistic sister, who's played by Alva Ramstad, is getting from their parents. Now, like Angela says, the parents are, for the most part, background characters. And the child, she's 9 years of age, she doesn't ever express the feelings that she's having. She doesn't express the jealousies that she feels about the lack of attention that she perceives. But it's there in her face from the first moment that we see her.
Well, one of
the
first things
the car,
we see is her.
She's pinching her sister.
Yeah. And the sister's, obviously, the sensory ability is not at the highest level.
And
so
she can't verbalise pain in any way. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that thread runs the whole way through the film until this central point, this central moment when something happens and the relationship between them changes. And then she takes on a far more protective and kind of an introductory role in her sister's life.
And while we can't speak to the specifics of, you know, there are a couple of big events that happen here, really, Angela, but what we do begin to see is, or what I began to ask is, what kind of moral compass do these children have? Because particularly the children with the powers, you know, what do you use the power for? Do you use it for good? Mm-hmm. Do you use it for bad? What do you think Fuchs was getting at in that aspect of the film?
Well, look, you know, this really is a film that will make you think about, is there such a thing as, you know, this cherished idea we have that children are innocent and children are basically good. You know, when the younger sister befriends Ben and his particular, you know, telekinesis is able to make bottle tops spin through the air.
Yeah.
This kind of entertains her, you know, she's a bright spark and there is a little, you know, she's got an edge to her and stuff. So that's the perfect match for her. And then, of course, Aisha ends up being able to verbalise for Anna, the autistic sister. And so there's a really kind of, you know, a good pairing there with that. But this kind of creepiness that comes into this around children and what their moral compass is, you know, that's just the whole way through the film where you end up being quite, I was quite frightened by these children, for these children. And as John says, is, you know, the ordinary everyday is part of this. It's shot in a kind of social realist style. And that makes it even more frightening because These kids aren't on screens. They're not on phones. They're out doing really old-fashioned things like running around in the playground. They're out in the forest. They've got Etch-a-Sketches, which is used to huge effect, you know, in terms of, you know, the audience's sensory experience. It's non-stop, really violent scratching on an Etch-a-Sketch. You know, they're a plastic plane, dolls. It's really old-fashioned 70s style, you know, kind of toys. That gives it this even creepier feel. It's unbearably tense and stressful. I had to walk away from it a couple of times and I was like, God, am I going to make it to the end of this? It's very, very powerful.
And it does get quite dark. And I suppose what Eskil Fuchs spoke to me about on Monday night, John, was this idea that, in fact, the moral compass has to be whatever worked out by the child, and the child kind of needs,
it takes a while.
Yeah, it needs to be left.
While, yeah.
Needs to be left to their own devices. Yeah, they don't need to be helicoptered.
In the film's terms, good for want of a better word, does eventually triumph. That, and the climax of this film is brilliantly staged and very disturbing, but it does take them a while to come together and decide what the right thing to do is, and to discover who the real threat is in this little four-way relationship that's established. It takes them a few minutes, but they do get there in the end. And I think how Vogt has staged this film is really, really clever. The material, you know, there's another film about a psychokinetic child, a Firestarter, the remake of the Stephen. It doesn't come anywhere close to that. That's not the way to think about a film like this at all. It's not a studio movie. And like Angela says, it really is a social realism, kitchen sink kind of drama with this element of magic.
It sounds as if it worked for you, John.
It did, yeah. I'd go and see it before the Americans ruin it, because they will remake this film and they will destroy it. So I would go to see it in its true form, original form. Yeah.
And what are you saying, stars-wise?
4 for me. I thought it was very good.
4 from you. Yeah, what are you saying, Angela, overall here, and stars for The Innocents?
I think this is going to be a classic, absolutely a horror, psychological horror classic. I don't think I'll be able to stop thinking about this for a couple of weeks. It's very, very impressive. 4 stars, but I would not sit through it again, quite honestly.
Yeah, so impressive, but it is a tough ask. Very interesting debate within it as well. The Innocents, the title of that film. Let's move on then to film number 3 this evening, Benediction, latest work from revered director Terence Davies. Poets have been a thing in recent times for him. A Quiet Passion from a while back, he brought the ever-mysterious American poet Emily Dickinson to life on the screen. Now he's focusing on Siegfried Sassoon, decorated war hero of World War I, who then channeled his visceral experience of the horrors of the front into exceptional poetry, and in fact became a real anti-war campaigner. Impassioned and vociferous campaign against the war itself was what he manned or kind of fronted towards the end of it. Angela, Terence Davies is never going to give you A, B, C, D, E, F, G and all the way to the to the end of the alphabet. There's always a kind of almost an impressionistic feel to his movies. What's he doing here?
Yeah, that's right. He isn't going to do that. And this film opens with a lot of newsreel and footage. So it has this kind of documentary feel that would remind you of his, you know, great film he made about Liverpool of Time in the City. So it's kind of reminiscent of that. But also, it's impressive. He's very brave. These entire poems in this delivered in voiceover. And that might be a big ask, you know, for a lot of audiences. It's really moving and I enjoyed it a lot. And people who are into poetry will enjoy that a lot. But then he kind of mixes it up a little bit. There's a couple of different styles going on here. And when we get into, Siegfried Sassoon's life in the 20s, with the social set that he fell in with Ivor Novello and the It Boy, Stephen Tennant, then we kind of get into a bit of a farcical Oscar Wilde period drama. And so it's a mixture of those two styles and also, you know, a serious drama and biopic of Sassoon as a man. So that's the territory.
And we do get two performances of Sassoon, or two versions of Sassoon, in Jack Loudon as the younger man, essentially, and Peter Capaldi arrives later into the film. But let's stick with the Jack Loudon one for the time being, because he's the one we see before the war, the war hero, but then coming home from the war, injured, in inverted commas, some would say, or what was going on? Did he get an easy way out?
Yeah. Was it a psychological injury or a physical injury, or was it just that he had had enough? And when we do come back to World War One is still raging, and he's put into a military hospital, and his outlook sours, and it's the film is a sad and melancholy movie. There's no mistake about it. It's beautifully acted and heartbreakingly sincere attempt to distill Sassoon's life into a 2-hour biopic. But Davies bookends that narrative with two distant events. There's this 1914 performance of Stravinsky's scandalous ballet, The Rite of Spring, and then the 1961 stage production of the popular musical Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And they're really at both ends of the film. The first one we witness with Loudon, the other one we witness with Capaldi. And the gulf in creativity and culture, in taste, I suppose, that separate those two events parallels the poet's own evolution from this resolute, principled man that we meet as Loudon to this bitter and sad and desperately lonely man outside of time, almost completely forgotten and obscure. He passed away in the late 60s at the age of 80. And it is that, that gap between them. Now, Davies, to my mind, handles that split role incredibly well. I mean, they're entirely convincing as both as aspects of the same character without either being a kind of an impression or you know,
I think an impersonation. Let's have a listen to a clip which features, this is Jack Loudon in an early scene, in fact, being interviewed, he arguing here with the journalist and critic Robbie Ross in connections to Oscar Wilde there, obviously. Robbie Ross, character played by Simon Russell Beale, Jack Loudon as Siegfried Sassoon. And here they are having a discussion about what actually happened to Sassoon and how he got back home.
I suppose this was your doing?
Yes, and Eddie Marsh.
I take this very ill, Robbie. Why did you involve Marsh?
Because he is principal private secretary to Winston Churchill and he wanted to help. He was instrumental in getting your medical board examination instead of a court-martial. If you were found guilty at a court-martial, you could be shot.
That was a risk I was prepared to take.
But there are those who care for you and who are not.
Court-martial would have been a platform to state my opposition to the conduct of the war, and you have prevented me doing so. And not only for this Times article, but for my statement to be read out on the floor of the House. You've rendered me impotent, Robbie. You've robbed me of my dignity.
Better that than a firing squad.
That is a matter of opinion.
Don't be angry with me, Siegfried. My intentions were honourable.
Simon Russell Beale there as Robbie Ross and Jack Loudon as Siegfried Sassoon in that scene from Terence Davies' film Benediction. The whole conscientious objector, the whole court martial issue is touched on in that scene. Angela, how is it handled? In terms, does Davies come down on one side or the other of that argument?
No, he doesn't really. And, you know, because I did have a question there about Sassoon's motivation. You know, I mean, he's really, he was very, very privileged, very well connected. And so when he wrote a soldier's declaration, this letter that was read out in the House of Commons and was published, you know, he was spared a court martial, as the clips, you know, as is implied there, potentially facing a firing squad. So they send him off to this military mental hospital in Scotland. And I really enjoyed the scenes there because I thought the performances actually from Loudon in particular was really, really nuanced, because this is where he comes to terms with his homosexuality, where he first admits to it. And he does it with in these sessions with a psychiatrist, a Dr. Rivers, who's played a great performance from Ben Daniels, and really beautiful chemistry between Loudon and Daniels in these lots of long silences, you know, in their sessions. And I think Davies really took his time. He allowed the silences work very well. But crucially, this is where Sassoon meets the, you know, a young poet called Wilfred Owen, who, you know, people who know poetry will know is one of the war poets who was killed in action when he left that hospital and was sent back to the front. But this, Davies, is what we're told is that this is the first great love of Sassoon. It was a very you know, pure relationship that they had. And of course, Owen was of a lower class to him and all of that. And when he's killed in the war, this grief is carried by Sassoon through his entire life, because, you know, it was the love that never was, but also he considers Owen to be the greatest of the war poets, and he carries that along with him. And there's a beautiful scene when Owen is leaving to be sent back to the war, and they're outside the hospital, and they just stand there in silence. And it's so naturalistic, you know, the awkwardness because of what they cannot say. And for me, that was the best scene in the film.
Yeah, of course.
You know, really extraordinary.
And Davies really knows how to let nothing be said and just let the visuals do the work.
Crucial,
what about the kind of bright young things aspect that comes along then as the war?
Yeah,
as
he's never
kind of recovering
Loudon,
from the war.
Indeed, Sassoon might not have been, but Loudon is never entirely comfortable being surrounded by these bright young things. Stephen Tennant, played by Callum Lynch, and the songwriter and prize bastard Ivor Novello, played by Jeremy Irvine. And that whole section of the film shows the kind of decadence of the era and the emptiness of it, if you know what I mean. Sassoon is looking for some transcendental moment. He's looking for something to write poetry about. And all he finds are these kind of louche, lazy, decadent men hanging around smoking cigarettes in silks.
Yeah.
And
well,
it doesn't satisfy him at all.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a clip which gives us a sense of that. Jeremy Irvine's playing the Ivor Novello character here. They're arriving at a party. Two important people, Hester Gatty, who eventually will become Sassoon's wife, in fact, played by Kate Phillips in this scene, and Stephen Tennant, as you mentioned there, played by Callum Lynch.
All the fine young cannibals. Make it sound like a raiding party, isn't it? Stephen Tennant.
I am...
Yes, we already know who you are, Stephen. But who is this absolute dream in oyster grey silk?
Hester Gatty.
Lady Gatty's daughter?
Yes. She once invited you to Carlton House Terrace, but you hardly noticed me.
Then I apologise for my lack of taste.
We're great admirers of your poetry, Siegfried. Before you take offence, Ivor, we like your work too.
Careful, Stephen, that was almost enthusiasm.
Perhaps they will play one of your charming songs, Mr. Novello, and then we could dance to it. I can't tempt Stephen, though.
Why not? Because I only do the Valita, and only when pressed.
A scene there from Benediction featuring Kate Phillips, Callum Lynch, the son, incidentally, of Finbar Lynch and Niamh Cusack, the Irish actors, and Ivor Novello, played by Jeremy Irvine. How does it all work out then, finally, Angela, as it switches into Capaldi as the older Sassoon, which comes quite late on, I think?
It does. And, you know, it flips between Capaldi's memory of the war and, you know, it flips between the two actors, you know, and I found those transitions a little bit clunky. But I mean, the clip we've just heard there, those are basically the big loves of Sassoon's life. You know, he had an affair with Novello. I think that Stephen Tennant and him had a relationship for probably 6 or 7 years, and he ended up marrying Hester. So when we come towards the end of it, Stephen Tennant shows up again on Hester and Siegfried's doorstep looking to apologise, and he's turned away by, you know, a very embittered, hollow and
Capaldi
very crabby old man, which is Capaldi's Sassoon. And I found the difference between Loudon's portrayal and Capaldi's portrayal of Sassoon, this is a completely different character. And I felt it wasn't true to life, that it wasn't, you know, I felt Davies took a lot of poetic license there, because first of all, Sassoon did not live in a suburban house that you could have rocked up to. Secondly, himself and his Hester had decades before.
All right, sorry, I'm interrupting
really
you there.
I'll
interrupt you there, Angela. Stars on that?
3 stars for those reasons. 3 stars, John.
3 stars. What are you saying, John?
I'm saying 4. I think films about disappointment and films about bitterness are difficult. And this is not an easy film to watch. But I think Davies' own sensibilities come through here. And if you like his work, you're going to like this film.
All right. 3 stars from you as well. Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Innocents are in cinemas nationwide, while Benediction is in selected cinemas. A man and woman meet 15 years after the end of their sexual relationship, an ending brought about not least because she was underage at the time and he subsequently went to jail. Una is in her 20s now. Ray is in his mid-50s. Mae Fitzgerald and Declan Conlon take on the roles in David Harrow's controversial and award-winning play Blackbird. Andrew Flynn directs for Decadent Theatre Company, and obviously a discussion that will have topics that are very sensitive indeed to be spoken about. Judy Murphy has been to see the play. She joins me now from Galway to tell us more. It's easy to see why Blackbird caused such a stir when it premiered at the 2005 Edinburgh in the International Festival. But even just as I described it there in that introduction, you can't get away from the difficulties and the controversy of this play, Judy.
You can't, Sean, really. And that's the kind of extraordinary thing about it. It opens with her having found him 15 years after their relationship ended, as you say. He has changed his identity. He has done time. They're at the cusp of entering the canteen in this grubby kind of down at heel building area, an old factory or a factory or wherever, and he's now in kind of lowly management there. And as it unfolds, the reason for her visit, is she there for closure? Is she there to find out what happened? Why is she there, I suppose, is the first question. And it begins, she dances around that, even though she has a load of questions for him. She dances around that at the beginning by discussing the state of the canteen, which is pretty grubby and grotty. And it unfolds from there, and it really is an unsettling piece of theatre. It's a really powerful piece of theatre, but it challenges you at kind of almost every level. This relationship or liaison or whatever you might care to call it.
Yes, let's have a listen to a clip. This is Declan Conlon playing the character of Ray, understandably shocked to find Una, played by Mae Fitzgerald, at his workplace. And this is a clip from the current Decadent production of the play.
But we won't be interrupted. I don't want people walking in here.
Well, what is there to interrupt? What are you wanting? I don't have much time. And to be honest,
What?
I don't have to be in here with you. You know that, don't you? You're aware of that. I don't have to stay here, do I?
No, you're right.
I don't have to listen. I don't have to say anything. So, but a few minutes, a couple of minutes, and then you will have to go, and because I'll be needed back.
Declan Conlon there and Mae Fitzgerald in that scene from David Harrower's Blackbird, new production from Decadent Theatre, which opened at the Don Howell Galway Theatre, currently touring, and in fact at the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin at the moment. There's an English setting originally to this play. What has Decadent done with this production? Are we in an Irish situation?
We're in an Irish situation, and when they run away, as runaway they do, to have they're going to elope. I mean, the premise is kind of bonkers, but actually the premise is based on a true story of an American Marine who groomed an 11-year-old girl and eloped with her or ran away with her to Paris in 2003. But this is his plan and her plan, and bear in mind that she's just a child. So they go to this B&B in a seaside town with a view in the north, with a view to taking a ferry to Scotland. And there they have sex, and there it begins. The whole thing begins to implode very, very rapidly. The concealment that they had managed, he's a neighbour of their family, and the concealment that they had managed up to then falls apart because the circumstances that happened that night. And he ends up on trial
Clearly a very complex topic to be discussed here, and that has to be handled with great care. I suppose initially that care has to be there in Harrower's script. It was an award-winning as well as controversial play, this. How does Harrower handle the very difficult questions that need to be asked here?
Well, he doesn't give you any easy answers. It is a hard play because you're dealing with how a relationship or a connection or a neighbour kind of thing between two people, one in their 40 and the other of 12, spirals out of control and where it gets to. And The Ray character gives all, you know, has been through therapy. He has been to prison. He has had counselling. He gives all the reasons why it was wrong. Mm. He also gives all the reasons why he fell in love with her, the adult within the child, the woman she would become. She, on the other hand, is kind of, she wants explanations, but she also wants closure. Her part of her upset, apart from what happened at all, is that he left and she never saw him after that night. Even though she gave evidence in court, she hasn't seen him since then. Mm. He obviously hasn't seen her either. But she has... She's the one who's come looking for him. So that in itself is a really kind of... that challenges you at every level. I mean, he really does challenge you, because when you think of relationships with children, adults, children, paedophilia, stuff like that, you kind of have a black and white perception of it. And he doesn't...
But statutory rape is black and white, really. There is, there is no grey area there.
No grey area. And I absolutely... I mean, I his character is not a likeable character, and the end of the play really, really rattled me. And I mean, the woman's vulnerability was quite extraordinary. There's no question about that.
So
he presents it in a more complex way.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no question, but in my sitting there watching it, I mean, I'm thinking this is wrong. But you, it's how your man justifies it and how her kind of thing. But all the time you keep thinking, or I kept thinking, she was a child.
Yeah, of course, that is the bottom line in many ways on it. But that says, the way you're describing what you began to feel and ask questions about says a lot here to the performances of Declan Conlon and Maeve Fitzgerald.
The performances are really strong, and I think that has to be... I think you really need a good... strong actors, and I think you need a rapport of some sort between them, because in the hands of people less accomplished than these two, I think you could have a very kind of, it could be a very tawdry kind of a thing. It's pretty tawdry as it is, I have to say. But the pull between them, their emotions are on a knife edge towards the end of it. I mean, there is nowhere to hide in the set. The set is so bit bare and so kind of basic, and the lighting is so harsh. But even with that, she finds somewhere to hide when somebody else comes in, or there's a kind of a brief appearance from somebody else. But I thought her performance especially was very powerful, because it's a really hard role to play. And he, as it all goes along, and he's kind of a down at heel character to begin with anyway. He's a kind of a look of a beaten dog about him. And he gets even more and more dishevelled and more decrepit as the play goes on.
This is Decadent's second time to perform or produce this play. They had, there was a production previously with Stephen Brennan in the role, now being played by Declan Conlon. Stephen Brennan was in on the programme with us last night, in fact. And Catherine Walker then played the part of the young...
Landmark, I think.
Oh, was that the Landmark production,
I think it was. Decadent did it in 2009 for the Arts Festival, and I think it was Stuart Graham and Judith Roddy were in that production.
Do you think brought them back to the play then? You mean, did you see that production back in 2009? And are there different qualities in this production? Is it saying something in 2022 that it wasn't saying in 2009?
I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I suppose I'm not sure that I have changed my perception on what I thought of it and what I thought of the kind of the dynamic between them. I mean, the performances are different, and it is a very taut, tight production. But is it saying anything new? I don't know that it is. I mean, can you say anything new?
Yeah.
So
still
like
the same complexities and still the same unanswered questions.
Yeah.
Is it a production worth seeing? It isn't an easy play to watch, that's for sure.
No, it's not easy, but it's not terribly long. It's 75 minutes, and for most of that 75 minutes, you really are kind of like you're leaning forward. It is worth seeing. It is a very unsettling production. The end of it particularly, I found really disturbing. And afterwards, chatting to men, actually, it seems to me that they had a different perception of the ending than I did. And I think that's what makes it intriguing, is the what happens towards the end really kind of unsettles you. And it's not an easy watch, but it is a really good night of theatre, if that's not a a contradiction.
No, like, easy to watch doesn't necessarily mean bad, that's for sure. Not no, easy to watch doesn't necessarily watch. Mean bad. Yes, absolutely. Judy, thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Judy Murphy. Blackbird is at the Nina Arts Centre Tipperary tomorrow and Saturday. It's at the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin from the 24th to the 20th of May, finishing up in County Mayo for two nights in the Town Hall Theatre in Westport, 1st of June, Ballina Arts Centre on the 2nd of June, decadenttheatrecompany.ie. Dances Like a Bomb is the latest work from the multi-award-winning dance innovators Junk Ensemble, performed by actor Michael Murphy and leading Irish dance artist Finola Cronin. Celebrating the strength and beauty of mature bodies and challenging the cult of youth, the performers are vulnerable, comedic, acerbic and completely themselves. The performance will be part of the Dublin Dance Festival. With me in studio this evening, Megan Kennedy from Junk Ensemble and Finola Cronin, one of the two performers involved. Megan, what brought you to particularly to explore these themes of ageing and ageing in relation to dance, I suppose, is quite a big topic, isn't it?
It is. It's very large. And thank you for having us on the show. We love being on your show. We were really interested in working with Michael and Finola and creating a duet between the two of them. We've worked with them both previously and they're both fantastic performers. They have met each other before, back in their UCD days, but we really wanted to bring them together and create a show around this idea of the aging body and seeing mature bodies on stage and this idea that actually when you can do less, that's a positive, there's a positive spin on that. There's something really beautiful about that. There's a beauty in aging. So looking at those themes that are very large, as you say, but really trying to dig as deep as we can into that to see actually what does it mean to when your body starts to change and when you do start to age.
And Finola, I mean, in many ways, I suppose the classic idea around a dancer and a classical dancer or a dancer in a show is that, well, the body can only take that probably into your 30s and then you kind of have to put it to the one side. But you come from, I suppose, a place in dance that from the outset had a different idea around it. I mean, you worked with Pina Bausch. Let's talk about that particular area of contemporary dance and what that, you know, new movement in the, suppose, the 60s, because 60s and 70s, what that brought to dance. Because it was all about be who you are. Don't be trying to be somebody else.
Yeah, I suppose maybe what happened was, first of all, with Pina's work, there was a sort of a leaning into theatre as much as dance. That was the first thing. And the second thing was, I suppose, to not just think about virtuosity and not just think about, you know, shapes and what your body can do. So bringing one's life, you know, experiences to your performance. So that's one of the things, I suppose, that happened. And I think that's something that Pina certainly didn't initiate those ideas. I think they were there from Netherlands Dance Theatre, you know, where they, you know, back in the 70s and 80s actually had separate companies, you know, so a particular NDT3, I think, might have been for the more senior dancers. And then they had a junior dancer, yeah, which was all around the various age groups. So, yeah, and I have colleagues who are still, and I'm in my 60s, I'll declare, who are still in their 60s and still working with the repertoire that Pina created. So there is a sense of longevity, I suppose, in certain styles in this sort of dance theatre.
Yeah, and that absence of virtuosity, certainly that the focus wasn't on virtuosity.
Wasn't absent.
I was going to say absence isn't the right word sure, because, but what we were really speaking about, and I think what we're speaking about in this piece, it's about doing what's right for you and your body, not what you can or can't do. It's not about cans and can'ts.
Because the irony is actually it feels, you know, my body when I do something, you know, I kind of do feel like as I did 30 years ago. You know, it's only when I see that I realise, of course, that's not it. So it's this issue between what you look like and what you feel becomes really acute in dance. You know, that's what the critical thing is. But I'm still sending the same messages from my brain, you know, to my fingertips and down to my knees and into my toes, if you like. But that will actually look very different.
Yeah, and Finola there, Megan, speaking about this idea that I suppose that Pina Bausch and that whole period around the 60s and 70s really is the period where I think we're speaking about there, that you're looking at this leaning into theatre and the fact that you've Michael Murphy there as well, theatre artist quite definitely, and coming from that mime background, the Jacques Lecoq School of Mime, I think that Michael attended. Is there something in a theatrical performance that is different from dance, or do you see the two as really the same thing?
I think they're the same thing, and Michael's a fantastic mover, and that's what was drawn to us to work with him for another production called Dolores, which was an adaptation of Lolita. So the idea of bringing text into the piece and bringing themselves into the piece was something that was very potent for us. So they ask each other a series of questions like, what are you waiting for? What haven't you done yet? What do you need to do? What would you take back? When were you at your best? When were you at your worst? Mm. And they reply in very honest answers. And some of that is movement driven as well. So I guess that idea of bringing the theatricality into the dance, but the bodies are telling the stories just as much as the words are.
Yeah, because another question that comes up, and you touched on it, Fionnuala, is this idea of you're saying one thing in your brain, or your brain is sending the messages out, but perhaps it doesn't look the same as it may have looked 20, 30 years ago. Are we talking about limitations in terms of the physicality here? Or is it about actually, you know, accepting those or not even thinking? I don't like that word limitations, I suppose, is what I'm touching. Because are we limited? Yeah. Are you limited in any way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and it's a range of things, really. It's probably the power is not necessarily there. I don't have the power. I can't call on that. Mm. I can't rely on it to be there. So I have to work much more carefully. I don't have the muscle power. I will only stretch as, you know, again, in a very limited capacity, to be honest, because I haven't been working full time either. I stopped for a long time. A good decade where I wasn't doing any kind of dance, you know, where I'll sort of joke and say I wasn't even going for a walk. I sat, you know, for a good 10 years.
Are we in the use it or lose it type of area then?
Kind of,
here?
Yeah. I'm very grateful to be trying to use it.
Now, the music, because there is music involved here as well, from Dennis Clossy, isn't it, who gives us the music. Let's have a little piece of Resistance to Care is the title that we have here. Title of that piece, Resistance to Care, from Dennis Clohasey. It's a very interesting, very interesting title, Megan. Megan Kennedy of Junk Ensemble with us this evening, along with Fionnuala Cronin, talking about Dances Like a Bomb. Resistance to Care, to whom are you talking there? Or who do you think is resistant to care?
Perhaps it's not as self-explanatory as I thought. We're looking at a lot of ideas of care, so vulnerable care, overcare, uncare, and resistance to care is one of those. And it's this idea that perhaps you care for someone too much and they resist that, or as the caree, that you resist the fact that you need that care, you resist the fact that you are getting older, that you rely and depend on someone else. And these ideas of codependency is coming into the work a lot. So that particular piece, we were working around the movement task of resistance to care, and both Michael and Fionnuala equally switch off with being resistant to that.
And it's a lovely stately pace, I have to say, to that particular piece of music as well, Fionnuala. But I can imagine that working with Michael Murphy, rehearsing with Michael Murphy and working with Michael Murphy is quite a challenge in terms of not spending your time having too much fun.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. You know, it's been terrific. It's been really enriching, I have to say. The exploration of ideas about aging has been absolutely extraordinary. And I think maybe one of the entries into it was we were in rehearsals and we were rehearsing aging. I think that was one of the approaches I think that we took about what does it feel like, you know, to be resisting care or to be supported by somebody and so on.
Now, you've worked with choreographers, I'm sure, who are difficult taskmasters. What's it like with the Kennedy pair?
They are total dotes.
And who is it you were referring to? I think this idea of it's been like in the room with your parents. Were you referring to Megan and sister? Who said that?
Certainly not me.
No. Who was that, Megan? No.
But no, they did say it. In rehearsal.
Yeah. Yes, you see, you have to be really careful what you say.
You said, it's just like rehearsing with your parents.
I bet that
it?
Was Michael.
Oh, pass the book immediately.
He's right. Not here.
Yeah, so, and Megan, it's you and your sister that are the parents in this particular case. Is that,
yeah.
That's the idea. Well, I suppose we get a sense of that when we get to see the piece. Megan Kennedy and Finola Cronin, Dances Like a Bomb by Junk Ensemble, is at the Project Arts Centre from the 25th to the 26th of May. And more about this year's Dublin Dance Festival at dublindancefestival.ie.